Election day is right around the corner. Campaigns are counting down to November 6th, rallying supporters and trying to sway any undecided voters. We're bringing you a series of conversations with candidates on the ballot in Taylor County. Today, Congressman Jody Arrington joins me by phone. The 46-year-old Republican is wrapping up his first term as the U.S. Representative from Texas's 21st Congressional District. He serves on the Budget, Agriculture, and Veterans Affairs Committee. Congressman, I'd like to start by looking back at your first term. What vote did you feel most proud to cast over these past two sessions?
Well, thanks, Heather. Good to be with you. That's a great question. There were a lot. The number one issue legislatively was to get cotton back into the Farm Bill safety net. It was the only commodity taken out during the 2014 Farm Bill. And it represents billions of dollars and lots of jobs, and really it's the livelihood of many who live in West Texas, and it is the basis of our economy. So I'd say the effort that I did to help lead the initiative to get cotton back in and the vote cast to make sure that West Texas would have a prosperous future, I'd put that at the top of the list.
Now, is there something that you think you learned or experienced that either surprised you or shifted your perspective these past 2 years?
You know, absolutely. I grew up in West Texas, and when we talk about conservative values and principles and sort of those affiliated with the Republican Party, it's not the same throughout the country. That is, the Republican tent is bigger and broader and more diverse than I even anticipated. You have suburban, some of my friends like Brian Fitzpatrick, a fellow freshman from the suburbs of Philly, some folks from the suburbs like John Faso of New York City. So those guys that are in urban and suburban areas who are Republicans have a different dynamic. And in order for us to keep the majority, while we advance the conservative principles of the Republican Party and what we believe is best for our country, we have to do it in a way that we bring all people on board. So that means that I don't get everything I want, and I don't generally have legislation that's always as conservative as I'd like to go. But that's part of governing, is finding consensus. Sometimes it's finding consensus across party lines. Sometimes it's within your own party. I just didn't appreciate that kind of consensus building would have to happen even inside the Republican conference. And I would say that, on the heels of that, I'm also pleasantly surprised at how much bipartisanship we've accomplished and that we've undertaken in the 115th Congress, making it the most bipartisan in terms of bills that were sponsored by Democrats and Republicans, voted out of the House and signed by the president, than any Congress in 20 years. And that to me, that's important to me as much as anything else, as much as advancing our conservative principles, because I think it's good for the country.
Now, you were talking about consensus building and as well about your pleasure in seeing the Farm Bill include cotton. But that bill has run into some trouble and hasn't quite gotten through. Mike Conaway has said he's hopeful that it will be passed this year. I'm wondering, what do you see as the key to getting it through? It has been a contentious bill this time around.
You're right, Heather, and I am disappointed that we couldn't get a bipartisan bill even out of the House, let alone through the entire reconciliation process and onto the conference committee, onto to the president. While 75% of the bills have become law that we've passed out of Congress have been bipartisan, there are some that are partisan. And in this case, I stand firmly on making this, getting it out of the House in a strictly partisan vote, because the hang-up was putting work requirements on able-bodied adults, not vulnerable people like pregnant women or disabled or elderly, but able-bodied adults where we're saying, look, we're expecting you to work at least 20 hours or volunteer or be trained in order to receive food stamps. And that's 85% of the Farm Bill funding. It's $70 billion. So I think it's important that we not trap people in a cycle of dependence on government. I think it's important we incentivize with policies to pull people up and out of welfare. I'm all for a safety net, but I'm for one that's responsible and that works in the favor of these folks and our communities and our economy. And since it's 85% of the Farm Bill funding, I stand firmly on that, and I think it's more than reasonable, but we didn't get a single Democrat vote because of that, and I was disappointed by that.
Well, there has been a lot of talk about the Democrats regaining control of the House. If that happens, what will it take to get the Farm Bill done?
Well, I think they will have a stronger hand in the House because it's a simple majority in the House. The Senate, as you know, runs with a 60-vote rule, which means they have to find bipartisan consensus regardless. I think it would strengthen their hand. We may have to say, look, farmers and ranchers are hurting ag country, and our ag economy has suffered greatly under trade inequities and high cost and low commodity prices. And, you know, I don't want to do anything that would put more farmers out of business, because we've seen a 40% increase over the last 3 years in farm-related bankruptcy. So I'm going to do what I can to give that lifeline of the Farm Bill and the certainty that our ag producers need. I just want to do it in a way that also includes responsible welfare to work reforms, but I'm not going to tie it up ultimately on that. I'm not going to let our guys suffer on account of that. At some point, we've got to be able to move it forward, but I'm going to keep pushing, keep fighting, and keep trying to convince the hearts and minds of those on the committee to take something more akin to the House Farm Bill.
Now, you mentioned the trade inequities, and the Trump administration has pursued tariffs, and Senator Ted Cruz drew a line between himself and the administration on this question. Do you support this approach to leveling the playing field? Do you think it's having the desired effect?
You know, it's a great question. There are many facets to it. So I support what this president's doing to create a more fair trade dynamic for American producers, manufacturers, and consumers. Right now, we like NAFTA. It was not the fairest and strongest deal that America could get, and he promised to make those improvements and modernizations, and it's better now. Canada now is allowing our dairy and wheat farmers in the Midwest to have access to markets they didn't have before, and we've increased the standards with respect to environmental and labor rules for Mexico, and we've got better enforcement, so we won't have that competitive disadvantage for U.S. producers and manufacturers. I think the auto guys would feel the same. Now, my best advice to the president was, if you want to hold China accountable and keep them in check, do more free trade in the Asia-Pacific region, not less. But listen, tariffs are a tool. They should be used sparingly, and they should be targeted, and they should be measured. But I think this president, in principle, is doing absolutely the right thing. We've already seen Canada and Mexico, that didn't want to come to the table and renegotiate NAFTA, do it, and do it in a way that was better for this country, for American citizens. And I think that ultimately, China has played us like a fiddle. I just read where they've stolen $600 billion of U.S. IP annually. And so the president needs a little runway to get it done. Yeah, there's some fallout from tariffs. He's done everything he can to smooth that out, especially for farmers and ranchers. But I support in principle what he's doing. And I think we're seeing the results of that are very positive. But all the results aren't in yet. But we've got to stick. I think we have to stand by our president on this one.
Okay. I want to switch gears and talk about health care. One of the goals of your Republican colleagues in the Senate and the House and the White House, they've all wanted to roll back the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. About a year ago, some in the Republican leadership had talked about moving on from replacing it. But now Mitch McConnell says Congress should try again. What do you want to see happen here?
I want to do away with Obamacare. I think President Obama and the Democrats I'm sure had every intention of providing affordable care, as it was called, the Affordable Care Act, but it didn't work. It was an abject failure. The government control, central planning, socialized medicine, you know, mandates, taxes, you know, big government solutions to healthcare are not the path forward for providing lower cost, better access and quality of care in this country. And now, the government has a role, and government has a role with seniors for the social safety net of providing care to seniors who are retired and to the poorest and neediest among us. But the vast majority of Americans would benefit from market forces like competition, where there are artificial barriers to that, like innovation, which I think would solve a lot of the problems, but there are government barriers to that. And I think mandating that insurance companies, you know, create certain products designed according to the government specs, and they in a way that doesn't really meet the needs and desires and the affordability of the consumer is wrong-headed, to be polite. And so that's why we've seen skyrocketing premiums and deductibles. So no, I want more competition. I want more choice for us as consumers. I want more transparency in pricing. I want more innovative products like association health plans. And I want more tax breaks for families who spend their discretionary money too much on healthcare. I think that brings the cost down, and I think that provides us with a future that's bright in terms of continuing to provide the highest quality of care, where you've seen it suffer in other countries that have applied universal health care.
What about covering pre-existing conditions?
I'm all for it. I mean, that's, you know, somebody asked me once, is there anything about Obamacare that you like? Because you speak about it with such vitriol. Well, yeah, I do, because too many working Americans and working class families and middle class folks, they can't afford to even pay their bills anymore because we've driven cost up because of Obamacare. But if there's one thing that I would say that has been a positive is, to be fair, is that I think pre-existing conditions are something the government ought to provide some support to people with that are high risk with pre-existing conditions. Because if the market will solve most of our problems. But if they truly have risk-based premiums for a middle-class or a working-class family or individual, there's no way they could afford the true risk-based premium if they had pre-existing high-risk conditions. That's where I think risk pools come into play. States ought to run them, in my opinion, but I do think government can provide and should provide some support there. I think that's appropriate. I think it's a responsible role for government. So yes, I support that.
Now, if we could turn to one of the hottest topics this election season, immigration. Your opponent, Mr. Lavario, has said he thinks there's a basic misunderstanding just even from where both sides are beginning the conversation. You have talked about wanting to end chain migration, requiring employers to use E-Verify. What do you think the best approach to border security is? Is the wall an answer?
Well, I think the wall and physical barriers get a lot of attention. I support them because they are a meaningful and important part of border security. But they're not the only part. I believe in a comprehensive plan to secure the border that includes more Border Patrol agents, and we've done that in the past 2 years. We just haven't done enough of it. I believe we have the technology to build a virtual fence or wall that's much smarter in terms of its ability to not only keep people out, but to let us know before they even get to the border with contraband, with human trafficking, with gang and criminal activity, often, not always, but often. And I think the big issue from my perspective is turning off the magnets that draw people here. Look, if we don't want people to come to this country illegally, that is, if we want them to come and we welcome immigrants, I think that immigration and the new American is quintessential to this country and to our history and to our future, because We want freedom-loving, hardworking people to have the opportunities afforded by this beacon of freedom and opportunity called America. And that I believe in that. But I believe in that with the respect to the Constitution and rule of law. And we've got to turn the magnets off of providing social services, except for emergency health care. I mean, if they, you know, but all the social services we provide to people who aren't taxpaying Americans, $100+ billion, it's tremendous drain on a system that's already, for all practical purposes, insolvent in terms of our $21 trillion debt and the expiring funds out of Social Security and Medicare, et cetera. And then of course, I think many come over for a job and for a better quality of life for their family. And while I respect that and I appreciate that, there is a proper and legal way to do that. So I think we have to hold employers accountable. And that's why I think E-Verify is an important part of stopping illegal immigration. You have to turn off the supply of jobs and services we provide, and then the demand will go down, and we'll see actually that we can solve the problem by just stopping some of the nonsense. And then, look, I've also said that we need a merit-based system for immigrating people to the United States and make sure that, just like, you know, people's place of business, just like their homes, they don't just let anyone join their company or their nonprofit. They want to make sure that they are going to contribute and that they will be part of the ideals and culture and values of that company or organization. Why would we do any different for our great United States? So I think we need to change that so that we bring people here who want to be here, who will work, play by the rules, and be loyal to the American ideals and be great American citizens and contribute to this country. I see that as just common sense.
Well, meanwhile, the Trump administration is proposing the lowest caps on legal immigration for 2019. I mean, is that you're saying you do support legal immigration, but do we want to lower the caps to 30,000 for next year?
Well, we need to have the right number that's good for our country and what we can absorb and what is good for the economy. We already have 7 million, I think, surplus jobs. 2 million have come about since the free market policies that Republicans have put in place to cut taxes and regulations. So, look, we need the labor supply. So we need to make sure that we're looking at the HB1, the new H2C that I'd like to get passed for our guest workers. That's big for agriculture in West Texas. So, yeah, we need to fix the legal side, too, so that we have the not just the right kind of person that would be a great American, but the right number and in the right parts of this economy to keep it growing and to keep it strong. So I don't know if I could, quibble over the numbers exactly, but I could just tell you we need to have a number that makes sense and that's responsible, and then we need to have an efficient process that's not overly bureaucratic, burdensome, and costly, both to the immigrant and to the folks like our agriculture producers. The guest worker now is broken. We need to fix it.
The federal budget deficit is now at a six-year high of $779 billion, and it's set to top $1 trillion next year. As a member of the House Budget Committee, what do you think Congress needs to do to bring spending and taxing in line with long-held conservative values?
Well, another great question, and I think this is the long-term greatest threat to the United States and to my kids, and that's the $21 trillion debt. It's the deficit spending, and it's what might happen, and it's not might. If we continue on this course, we will have a sovereign debt crisis that will create – it'll turn this economy that we have finally off of high center and growing, and it will take this – record unemployment since 1969, haven't seen it this low, and it will turn it upside down, and we'll have high taxes, high unemployment, and a terrible environment and economy for our children. And so I think the answer is 70% of our budget is on auto spend. It's mandatory spending programs. And we've got to restructure them in a way that makes some of these programs solvent and sustainable. And then we need to put reasonable reforms on big means-tested welfare programs that have expanded out of control, like the food stamps and the work requirements we talked about earlier. Look, we spent, as a nation, $22 trillion to declare war on poverty back in the 1960s. The poverty rate was 14% then. It's 14% today. We have nothing to show for it, except that we've trapped people in a cycle of poverty and dependence. The best anti-poverty strategy is a job. So we need to provide a growing economy, policies that will keep this economy growing. But we've got to get after mandatory spending. And look, so far, I don't think Republicans or Democrats have done a good job at this. I think they've all failed at providing solutions to our budget crisis and our spending problem, which I think it's more about spending, because we have all-time high revenues right now, but our spending has just gone out of control because we have no balanced budget amendment like every state in the union essentially has. And without the political will, Heather, I don't know how, if it's not forced on us, I don't know how Congress is going to act. And I'm not being critical of just Democrats. Republicans have lacked the will, too, because we passed a balanced budget in the House and we cut $200 billion, which was the most cuts on mandatory spending in 20 years. We got it to the Senate, and all we needed was a simple majority of Senate Republicans, and we couldn't get it. So this is a criticism of both parties. And I think this spending is absolutely out of control and irresponsible. And that's, to me, the only path forward to getting our arms around it and making sure we have a solid footing for our children.
As a member of the Veterans Affairs Committee, you see a lot of proposals aimed at making sure those who served America in the military are being cared for. A recent focus of veterans issues is mental health care. Is the U.S. doing enough to ensure that veterans have access to the care they need in order to deal with the long-term effects of serving in the armed forces?
I think we can always do more. And I, as a member of the VA committee, I'm very proud that we passed 80 veteran-related bills out of the House. Almost 30 have become law of the land. And part of that was to give veterans more choice in their health care decisions. The VA works in some pockets, but in too many, it doesn't. And we've had reports that were national in their public and being publicized that veterans had waited in lines, got sicker, and even died because they couldn't get out of the single-payer system of the VA. So giving them choice to go to providers if they need to and want to in the, in their community is critical. I'd say the telemedicine, telehealth, telepsych, as we call it, is a great way to enhance access to mental health care services. And then, of course, I also introduced legislation to engage veterans while they're in their last phase of active duty and begin assessing what they may need in the transition, because in the transition it becomes very difficult, especially when you have wounds that you can't see. That's when we have the disaster of 20 veterans committing suicide every day, and that's unacceptable. So I think we're doing a number of things, but we can always do more for sure.
If we could wrap up by looking ahead, if you do win a second term, if there's just one thing you could accomplish, what would it be?
Well, that's an easy one for me. It's getting our country on the path for a good fiscal, responsible footing and get us into a solid fiscal trajectory so that we don't leave our kids this mess. It's really deceptive because, you know, if you don't have to cut programs and you can raise and you can cut taxes and you can do all these things, you know, with no pain, and yet the mountainous debt just continues to rise to the level that literally in 10 years or less, we'll spend more on just the interest on our debt than all of national security. That is crisis mode. We need to ring the bell, and we need to have the political courage to make the tough decisions to get this country back on solid fiscal footing. And that is to me the most important thing we could do for the future and for the next generation of Americans.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Heather, thank you.
Congressman Jody Arrington is running for re-election to Texas's 21st Congressional District. I'm Heather Claiborne. This is KACU.